Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Stephanie, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop update from the 2013 American Society of Hematology, ASH, annual meeting. And this is a very exciting call, and I know it's one that you're all very eager to hear. And this is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and it really is because of all of this collaboration that we have been able to reach so many of you on the call today. So we have over 850 participants on the call today, and you come from all over the United States. And we also have international participants from Canada, Ireland, Spain, the United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So it's really a credit to all of you that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us. Now, I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials you received from Cancer Care. In those materials is information about all of our collaborating organizations as a resource for each of you to utilize for help, in addition to your contacting Cancer Care. And we also included an evaluation form. I would ask you to take a moment and complete that evaluation form. You know, we very much depend upon your feedback in planning programs like this. Indeed, we're already beginning to plan next year's program on this topic, and very much would appreciate your thoughts and feedback. It helps us to keep the program most relevant to meet your needs. So tell us what you think, and tell us about other topics you'd like us to offer, and we will be sure to offer them. This program was made possible by Celgene, Millennium, the Takeda Oncology Company, Novartis Oncology, Onyx Pharmaceuticals, Inc., Teva Pharmaceuticals, Seattle Genetics, Inc., and an educational donation provided by Amgen. And I really want to thank each of these companies, and I also want to thank them for their collaboration in making today's program possible. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and our first speaker is Dr. Owen O'Connor. And Dr. O'Connor is Professor of Medicine and Experimental Therapeutics. He's Director, Center for Lymphoid Malignancies, Department of Medicine. He's Co-Director, Program of Lymphoid Development and Malignancies, Herbert Irving Comprehensive Cancer Center, Columbia University Medical Center, the New York Presbyterian Hospital. And Dr. O'Connor is going to discuss with you a bit about the American Society of Hematology, ASH, the annual meeting. He's going to tell you a little bit about understanding blood cancers, and then he's going to talk about lymphoma-specific treatment updates and research presented at ASH, as well as the role of clinical trials. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. O'Connor.
Thank you so much, and hello, everybody. I'm not sure if it's morning, afternoon, or evening, but whatever it is, I hope everybody's having a good day. As you heard just a moment ago from Ms. Messner, each year in the United States, the American Society of Hematology sponsors an annual meeting where it basically allows investigators who are interested, physicians and scientists who are spending their time focusing on developing new therapies and understanding the underlying mechanisms by how different blood cancers form, and we meet once a year, and we met last December in New Orleans, where tens of thousands of people get together to talk and share ideas and present their data with regard to how they're approaching some of these sometimes complicated diseases. When we talk about blood cancers, we're really talking about a very diverse group of malignancies, and all of these diseases basically arise from the bone marrow. They basically arise from white blood cells, red blood cells, and platelets, and different kinds of hematologists and specialists in malignant hematology focus on different kinds of blood cancers. I, for the moment, will be talking about lymphoma, where we focus mostly on these lymphoid diseases that are mostly derived from lymphocytes. You'll hear Dr. Morrow speak shortly about myeloid diseases like acute myeloid leukemia and chronic myelogenous leukemia, and then you'll hear Dr. Raj speak about multiple myeloma. These are all diseases that are basically derived from white blood cells, and they're incredibly heterogeneous, incredibly diverse, and they really run the spectrum of some of the slowest growing cancers known to science, also including some of the fastest growing cancers known to science. At ASH this year, there were a number of very exciting presentations in the area of lymphoma. And as many of you are probably well aware, there has been a marked increase in our understanding of these diseases in terms of the genetic changes that result in various kinds of lymphoma, and nothing less than an explosion in the number of new drugs that are emerging that are helping physicians better manage these diseases. And in fact, what you are going to probably hear more and more about with these diseases as time goes on is that we're beginning to think about new ideas that are not so chemotherapy predicated. Many of these new molecules are small molecules that really precisely target the unique pathology of the malignant cell, sparing the normal cell, and thereby oftentimes are associated with much less toxicity. And many of these new therapeutics are immunologic strategies where novel chemotherapy drugs are actually tagged right onto the monoclonal antibody, allowing very precise delivery of chemotherapy to these particular cancer cells. So there's really been a marked renaissance in terms of the numbers of new agents and how we're beginning to think about the future management of these diseases. At ASH this year, I'll start with an update of a study that many of you with B-cell lymphoma are probably well aware of called the PRIMA study. And the PRIMA study was one of the very first randomized clinical trials looking at the merits of rituximab in patients with follicular lymphoma, where the rituximab was given as a maintenance schedule after patients finished conventional chemotherapy. Typically, patients in this randomized phase 3 clinical trial were given either standard R-CHOP-based chemotherapy, RCVP, or FND, and then they were given standard rituxan maintenance once every 3 months for about 2 years. And some of you may be well aware of this data when it was presented earlier, which seemed to suggest that there was an improvement in what we call the progression-free survival. How long did patients go before they experienced a relapse of their disease? And Dr. Sales from France presented a 6-year follow-up experience on the PRIMA study, showing that, in fact, there still seems to be an advantage for patients who get maintenance rituxan with regard to their progression-free survival. So for those patients that got rituxan maintenance after their chemotherapy, almost 60% of them actually had a progression-free survival interval at 6 years, whereas those that did not get the maintenance rituxan, 42% of those patients hadn't progressed at 6 years. So that seemed like a big difference. But the important issue that keeps coming up with maintenance therapy is, was there a difference in the overall survival? And all of these studies continue to demonstrate that there's really no significant advantage in terms of overall survival. And in fact, in the PRIMA study, there was no difference in overall survival, but there was this interval in the progression-free survival. So physicians may tailor their recommendations for maintenance therapy depending upon a patient's specific situation, but this is an important update that was presented by the French at the ASH meeting. I think another very exciting presentation was made by the Italians, where they've been looking at strategies to try to improve the upfront care of patients with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, and modeled somewhat after an experience that had been reported previously by colleagues at the Mayo Clinic. They actually sought to explore the merits of adding lenalidomide to standard R-CHOP-based chemotherapy for patients with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. Now, they gave the lenalidomide, which is a immunomodulatory drug that has been shown to be very active in many different subtypes of lymphoma. It's also very active in multiple myeloma, as I suspect you'll hear shortly, and appears to be active in some forms of myelodysplastic syndrome. So they integrated lenalidomide with standard R-CHOP chemotherapy. They treated 49 patients, and they reported a 2-year overall survival of about 92%, with about 80% of patients being relapse-free at 2 years. What was really interesting about their data set, and confirmed some earlier observations reported by the Mayo Clinic, was that the regimen seemed to be particularly active in the subtype of diffuse large B-cell lymphoma that we know is often associated with a more challenging prognosis. And that subtype is what we call the ABC, or post-germinal center subtype of diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. I have no doubt many of you have probably heard about our efforts now to try to categorize categorize these diseases with regard to their molecular features. And in fact, diffuse large B-cell lymphoma we now recognize as many different types of diseases, but two molecular subtypes of the disease, the germinal center subtype and the ABC subtype, are now being studied very selectively in clinical trials. And the ABC subtype, those patients that have this activated B-cell phenotype of the disease, tend to have a somewhat more challenging prognosis. And the really good news is lenalidomide, and in addition to some other drugs like ibrutinib, appear to work very, very selectively in that more challenging prognostic subgroup. So that really portends some promising developments down the road as we begin to develop new therapeutic strategies for some of the more challenging forms of the disease. This is now going to lead in all likelihood to a randomized study where the sponsor will look at comparing patients with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma who get treated with standard R-CHOP chemotherapy and compare it to patients who are getting standard lenalidomide R-CHOP chemotherapy to answer very definitively if there's a benefit to adding lenalidomide. Another study that was reported by Dr. Yunus really followed the same theme, and he presented the results of a phase 1 study looking at the integration of ibrutinib into standard R-CHOP chemotherapy. Ibrutinib is a new drug that targets a protein downstream of the B-cell receptor that has been shown to be very, very important in the pathogenesis of B-cell lymphomas. And again, just like lenalidomide, it's been shown to be more active and that more challenging subtype of diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, namely the ABC subtype. And what Honest demonstrated is that adding ibrutinib to R-CHOP was very safe. It was well tolerated. They didn't see any toxicities above and beyond what you would expect for the standard R-CHOP chemotherapy. And they're now going into a phase 2 studies and in all likelihood will be leading to a randomized study. So these two studies I just mentioned are really very exciting because they're extensions of what we've been talking about on these calls for the last few years, which is a number of new drugs coming along for the for these subtypes of lymphoma. And now we're beginning to think about optimal ways to integrate those new drugs into the standard of care and, in fact, into the upfront standard of care to try to definitively change the natural history of these diseases. Another really interesting abstract was presented on a novel drug called crizotinib. And crizotinib is a drug that targets a very specific genetic lesion that is found in many different types of cancers. And, in fact, there's a cancer known as anaplastic large cell lymphoma that expresses a unique fusion protein resulting from a genetic switching of various genes called ALK. And ALK-positive anaplastic large cell lymphoma is not a very common disease, probably about 1,000 cases per year in the United States. But those patients that have this particular genetic lesion, this 2-5 translocation is what we call it, are now potentially candidates for this new drug called crizotinib. And it's really yet another example of how we're using our understanding of the molecular features of these diseases to precisely tailor and develop new drugs that go after those molecular lesions. So in fact, crizotinib specifically targets those forms of anaplastic large cell lymphoma that are ALK positive or carry this particular genetic lesion. And again, a very small study, and it was presented as an oral presentation only because it was so provocative. But they treated 11 patients, including 9 that had anaplastic large cell lymphoma and that 2 that had diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. One of the things we're learning is many of these genetic lesions that we historically always thought to be associated with one particular subtype of disease, now that we know the importance of those lesions, we're beginning to find them in other kinds of cancers. And in fact, ALK translocations are common in lung cancer, where this drug also has pretty marked activity. But remarkably, of the 11 patients, 10 of the 11 patients achieved a major remission to the drug. It's an oral drug, and these are patients that historically failed all known chemotherapy agents. And 9 of those 10 patients that responded achieved a complete remission. Now, this is really no panacea just yet. It's a very promising early drug and very early clinical studies. And just as I discussed with ibrutinib and lenalidomide, I am sure studies will be commencing shortly looking at the integration of crizotinib into standard therapies for anaplastic large cell lymphoma. Certainly, this drug alone didn't cure those patients, but they did achieve some reasonable duration of benefit. So a very early finding, but one that I think holds a lot of promise for treating not just anaplastic large cell lymphoma, but other types of cancer. Another interesting drug that you may hear Dr. Morrow speak a little bit more about is a new monoclonal antibody targeting CD20, a drug called obinutuzumab. And obinutuzumab has some features that render it a little bit different than Rituxan. In particular, it has these immunologic features engineered into the antibody that make it better for what we call ADCC. And this antibody-dependent cellular cytotoxicity is a prominent mechanism by which monoclonal antibodies kill these tumor cells, and obinutuzumab is thought to be much better at having at killing tumor cells through this ADCC-like mechanism. But a randomized trial was presented where they treated patients with CLL, chronic lymphocytic leukemia, and they treated them with obinutuzumab plus chlorambucil and compared it to patients treated with Rituxan plus chlorambucil. So in the United States, some critics have said, well, we don't really use that much chlorambucil. It's used much more commonly in Europe and other places around the world. But the trial nonetheless was really provocative for a marked difference in the overall response rate and the complete response rate in patients with CLL. And in fact, they treated nearly over 600 patients, and of those patients that got obinutuzumab chlorambucil, the overall response rate was 78% versus 66% in those patients that got Rituxan. And really more impressively, the number of complete remissions was much higher in the patients that got obinutuzumab, really confirming, in essence, some of our understanding of that underlying biology and how we think these drugs work. So I'm sure you're going to hear a lot more about new monoclonal antibodies coming along after Rituxan that are going to be engineered specifically to function a little bit better than Rituxan alone has functioned. And Rituxan, let me not suggest otherwise, has been a remarkable breakthrough and a remarkable drug that has really benefited many patients with B-cell lymphoma. You can only imagine that as we learn more about how these drugs work, we hope to actually improve that substantially. I'm going to talk about two more things, and then I'll turn the floor back. Another interesting drug that was presented by John Seymour was a drug called ABT-199. And ABT-199 is a drug that actually lowers the threshold required to induce the destruction or the cell death of the tumor cell. And Dr. Seymour and his colleagues have been studying this new drug, ABT-199, in patients with CLL. And again, I'm going to sort of raise just a thematic area here. When they looked at ABT-199 in patients with CLL, chronic lymphocytic leukemia, they actually demonstrated that they treated about 56 patients. And in these patients who had seen prior therapies, the overall response rate was 84%, which is pretty astounding. This is an oral drug in patients in whom they had failed prior traditional chemotherapy. But what really struck my attention is, just as I alluded to earlier, we're beginning to think about all of these diseases in a molecular context. So when we now talk about CLL, we don't just talk about CLL. We talk about what are the cytogenetic features of your CLL, and we now know that there are some cytogenetic features of CLL that are really good and others that are really bad. Well, one of the really bad ones historically has been loss of a part of a chromosome called 17p. That's an important area where an important tumor suppressor gene P53 happens to live. But what they demonstrated is that in this subgroup of patients, which historically don't respond to anything, these are patients that don't respond well to any traditional chemotherapy, and in these patients, that overall response rate was 82%. It was nearly identical as what it was in the general population. So they actually were able to demonstrate this. ABT-199 is not only active in all patients or most patients with CLL, but particularly active in those patients with poor risk disease. Another example of how we're really engineering drugs to target the unique biological features of the underlying disease has been demonstrated with a drug called brentuximab vedotin. Brentuximab vedotin is an antibody that is engineered to target a protein on the surface of the cell called CD30. So just as Rituxan targets CD20, this is engineered to target CD30. And CD30 is expressed on T-cell lymphomas, and it also turns out to be expressed to some extent on B-cell lymphomas. And so, again, another example where we begin to identify a target that's important, and then we understand how it influences other cancers. So Nancy Bartlett had conducted a study where she looked at brentuximab, which is FDA-approved for T-cell lymphoma, and she looked at it on patients with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, namely 43 patients. And in this population, she found that 40% of those patients with large cell lymphoma that had failed to respond to conventional therapy actually responded to this particular drug, which up to now has been studied predominantly in Hodgkin lymphoma as well as T-cell lymphoma. And I think it's emblematic of the future, which is trying to think about how we can use these drugs optimally across a whole variety of different cancers. Finally, I'll just talk about one abstract. It'll be the last one presented by our group, focusing on T-cell lymphomas. And as many of you are well aware, this is a very challenging subset of blood cancers that responds poorly to chemotherapy. But over the last few years, there's been a number of exciting new drugs like romidepsin and pralatrexate and now belinostat pending for the approval by the FDA for the treatment of these particular diseases. So belinostat is now being filed for approval, romidepsin and pralatrexate already approved. But what's becoming clear is that these T-cell lymphomas may be very, very vulnerable to the class of drugs that we call epigenetic drugs like romidepsin. And we presented some data showing that at least in preclinical models in mice with different forms of T-cell lymphoma, and we're now conducting a clinical trial of the combination, it really looks like an oral drug that affects this epigenetic apparatus plus romidepsin are able to produce cures in mice with these various kinds of T-cell lymphomas. And early signals in the clinical trial also appear very promising. So for those patients who are thinking a little bit about T-cell lymphoma, I would strongly argue that we need to consider clinical trials as the standard of care for patients with many of these diseases, because this is how we're going to move the needle and move things forward rapidly by enrolling in clinical trials. And that also means that for patients that are being presented with randomized clinical trials, many patients have the notion that they want to be put only on the experimental arm, that arm that is studying the new drug. And if they're not put on that arm, sometimes they feel like they don't want to contribute to the study. But I would urge everybody that we're doing the randomized trial because we don't know that adding that new drug is better. And it's really important for every patient with these diseases to consider a clinical trial where appropriate. So with that, I'll thank you very much for your attention and turn it over.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. O'Connor, for just a wonderful presentation on lymphoma and also for just setting the context for the program as well. Thank you. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. And our next speaker is Dr. Michael Morrow. Dr. Morrow is leader, Myeloproliferative Diseases Program, member, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, professor, Weill Cornell Medical College, New York Presbyterian Hospital. And Dr. Morrow is going to address an overview of leukemia, a leukemia-specific treatment updates and research presented at ASH, and talking with your healthcare team about your treatment options. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Morrow.
Oh, thank you, Carolyn. It's always difficult to follow Dr. O'Connor, who a clinician scientist I've known for a very long time, who just gave us a wonderful overview on philosophically how lymphoma and blood cancers really in general are being treated and approached. And I'd like to turn now our attention a little bit more towards leukemias, particularly chronic leukemias and myeloproliferative disorders, and what we learned from ASH, and talk a little bit about talking to your healthcare team about choices, because clearly the number of choices has vastly widened. I'll start by saying that at the ASH meeting this December, we not only learn about therapeutics, but we also learn about diagnostics and the tools that we need to understand the underlying biology and the things that make these diseases tick, which really sometimes indirectly, but almost often now directly, leads to discovery pathways for therapy. And probably one of the most exciting advances was announced the continued unraveling of the spectrum of disorders called myeloproliferative disorders, or MPNs. And in a pair of abstracts presented by two different groups who really, in somewhat in collaboration, but also in somewhat independently, discovered the same thing, which is always reassuring when two very large studies show and confirm the exact same result. We identified a molecular signature or a marker called calreticulin, which describes or identifies patients who have a myeloproliferative disorder who don't have, and this was exclusive, it was a black and white situation of either this new finding or the previously well-known finding of a JAK2 or MPL mutation, essentially fitting the remaining piece of the puzzle in, telling us what might we look for with regards to the mechanism of diseases which can look the same in the clinic, meaning the same problems and symptoms may present. But as we develop therapeutics and classify folks properly to get them on the best treatment and get them the best success, understanding the underpinnings is key. So this was a huge addition to our knowledge, and I'm sure will lead to rapid implementation of diagnostics to test for this. So ask for these tests, and also to ask about clinical studies or new drugs that may be developed that would potentially target such a finding. If something's found in a very significant proportion of patients exclusively who have a clinical condition, and this is at the molecular or cell level, there's a pretty good chance that that may be such a central player in the disease that a therapeutic target is now going to be developed. Additionally, in the area of myeloproliferative disorder, you saw an interesting compound called imetelstat, which is a telomerase inhibitor. A telomerase is our genes that are involved in aging cells. The shorter telomerase a cell may have, the more unstable it may be, and it's a natural phenomenon. But we see in cancer dysregulation of this pathway called telomerase. So an inhibitor to stop cells from becoming more genetically unstable or prone to appear as they're quite aged was implemented as a therapeutic strategy in myeloproliferative disorders. And this was remarkably effective with patients who we generally can't get as far as we did in this study, where we saw not only morphologic or bone marrow remissions, where the changes in the disease improved and blood counts improved and patients who needed transfusions no longer needed them, but also patients went into a molecular remission, meaning the molecular markers, not necessarily the target of this drug, but the thing that we know it makes the diseases tick went away, which was, I think, incredibly reassuring that such therapies could be that profoundly effective. We know we have good therapies in myeloproliferative disorders, and an analysis at ASH showed that when we looked in general at a group of studies called the COMFORT studies, a very nice name, which were implementing another class of targeted drugs called JAK inhibitors in myeloproliferative disorders, when we looked, we really are seeing the patients are living longer if they receive these therapies, which is good support for perhaps their earlier implementation and their use, perhaps at lower doses, which is a bit more common now given some of the side effects we better understand. So myeloproliferative disorders really saw a nice gain in knowledge. Turning then to CML, which has been under very aggressive scrutiny over the last decade, we really saw, and to quickly summarize, a continuation of a lot of the data that we've learned for that disease. We saw longer follow-up for patients treated at diagnosis of CML with one of two of the second-generation tyrosine kinase inhibitors, or TKIs, called either nilotinib or dasatinib. And the improvements you can see with these medications compared to imatinib or Gleevec, which is the drug first approved for CML in this realm in the tyrosine kinase family, continue to stand up over time. And the main benefits we're seeing are continued improvements in the traditional responses called cytogenetic and major molecular responses, and also some of the more novel responses we're looking at, which would include a complete molecular remission, where the level of leukemia marker called B-cerebral really falls below the level of detection in most laboratories. This may not mean that the leukemia is entirely gone, but it may be the next step, as we also saw more data at ASH on what does it mean to consider the possibility, and I want to highlight that it's not the standard and it's not something to do outside of a trial, but the possibility that someone may not need treatment for CML lifelong. There was also at ASH a reanalysis by the group in France, in Bordeaux, France. Dr. Rousselot and Dr. Mahone were the main scientists in this study, looking at if patients have a very idealized response to Gleevec and in a careful clinical trial did have the treatment held, how successful was that, and how can we look at what kind of patients might be eligible for such an opportunity? And I think we learned important lessons that we can probably think a little bit broader about which patients might be able to discontinue treatment in the future, not yet, because we have to continue these trials and get the questions answered. And the success rate can be defined a little bit differently, where more, instead of a minority, now a majority of patients may not show significant proliferation, anything that we would consider a relapse, a true relapse occurring with such a strategy. So that's exciting news that someday CML may be an illness that's not only functionally curable by continued medication, but may also be able to go into what's called a treatment-free remission. We also saw important updates for a new drug called ponantinib, and many people had heard news about this very effective drug, which really helps cases of leukemia with the Philadelphia chromosome, the pH-positive leukemia, is mainly studied and most effective in CML, where a mutation had developed or patients had had one or two treatments and had failed. We saw that with careful analysis, there is an enhanced risk of side effects, particularly in the realm of vascular side effects, even with updated data from clinical trials. And the FDA reviewed this data and temporarily kept ponantinib off the market. But it was actually brought back to the market right after the holidays on December 31st with some revisions to the label showing that it is safe to use under the right circumstances with the right precautions and then perhaps a slightly narrower group of patients. But it remains an important option for patients with pH-positive leukemia, particularly CML, in whom they may not have other indications for other drugs. They may be out of options, or they might have a certain mutation, like a T315I mutation, which can really not respond to other available medications. So ponantinib remains available, and again, with proper caution and counseling, can still be a safe option. As I don't want to stay in one disease area, let me move a bit to some of the other leukemias and highlight that I'm proud to say that some of my new colleagues at Memorial Sloan Kettering were able to present an extension of some of the data using engineered T-cells, or CART T-cells. So CART stands for chimeric antigen receptor and T-cells, and this is a very brilliant strategy where we use our own immune systems by taking a cell that belongs to a patient and engineering it to go back in and essentially get on the front lines and cooperate via normal pathways in the immune system, but to identify and to remove malignant cancer cells in the initial studies, malignant lymphocytes, particularly B lymphocytes, from the patient. So it's essentially turning someone's immune system on as an anti-cancer therapy. And our group, led by Dr. Marco Davila and Dr. Brengens, showed that in patients with ALL, that this strategy was highly effective and often got their disease under control at a molecular level, allowing them to obviously be in a state of remission and in many cases move to more definitive strategies, including bone marrow transplant. There's a large body of work that's been done in this field, and investigators at the universities in multiple places, particularly in Pennsylvania, have really pioneered this work, and there's multiple different ongoing studies, and it's very exciting, and patients are really looking for these studies, so I'd encourage people to discuss that option. In a few last moments, with regards to acute myeloid leukemia, I think we saw continued efforts at different clinical therapeutic interventions, but probably even more data on molecular characterization of leukemia. And many centers have very broad diagnostic capabilities to look at AML and to, as Dr. O'Connor had highlighted, to understand exactly what molecular defect or molecular signature, fingerprint, the leukemia might present. And that may be a moving target. We may have to acknowledge that. But clearly, this is going to lead to a rapid expansion of new therapies. And there are very specific therapies available in multiple clinical trials for acute myeloid leukemia, in addition to standard chemotherapy, which really can offer heightened rates of remission and really personalized medicine. And I think that's quite encouraging. I think Dr. O'Connor nicely covered some of the advances in CLL, and that was probably, aside from the myeloproliferative disorders in the leukemia, one of the most exciting stories with what we call plenary or main, the most highlighted session in the meeting showing improvements in patients treated with the novel anti-CD22 antibody, the obinutuzumab, and Dr. O'Connor covered that for us, showing that when used with chlorambucil, agreed, a medicine we don't use as much in the U.S., but we certainly could, in patients who had perhaps a higher risk for, with more intense chemotherapies, really gained both in with regards to remission rates and also survival advantages, progression, being free from their disease progressing and living longer with the addition of a new antibody therapy over, as he also mentioned, a very good antibody called rituximab, which still remains a very strong workhorse in lymphoid cancers. And lastly, getting down to the molecular level in CLL, we saw nice work with another target called the PI3 kinase, which if you think of leukemia as, or of any kind really as a, where a switch might get thrown and there's probably a current running down a wire, there's sort of subsequent switches down the pathway that have to be connected for the signal to get through. And as we identify specific switches that are central, that are bottlenecks, that if we hit them as anti-cancer targets, we can shut down leukemia. This may be one of them, and particularly scientists have identified certain forms of an enzyme or a switch in a blood cell might be targetable. And two different drugs, idelalisib, which I think was mentioned also by Dr. O'Connor, in patients with refractory CLL showed improvements in response with longer progression-free survival and overall survival, and also a broader compound called IPI-145, which is a broader drug that hits both forms of this enzyme, I think, showed very nice data in a phase 1 trial, which means it's safe and we have a dose established and we can move on to look at broader use. So overall, very exciting times in leukemia across the board, with better characterization of disease at the molecular level, better understanding of the targets, implementation of multiple new targets, and increasing confidence in some of the drugs we've had for a while, and even drugs we've had some questions about with regards to the safety. So I'll stop there.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Morrow, again, for a wonderful presentation and making it very helpful to understand some of the latest developments in leukemia. So thank you so much. And I know there'll be questions for you as well during the Q&A. And our next speaker is Dr. Nupur Rajay. And Dr. Rajay is Associate Professor, Department of Medicine, Harvard Medical School. She's Director, Center for Multiple Myeloma, Division of Hematology and Oncology, Massachusetts General Hospital. And Dr. Rajay is going to address an overview of multiple myeloma, multiple myeloma-specific treatment updates and research presented at ASH, and quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Rajay.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's a pleasure for me to be here this afternoon as well. And as Dr. O'Connor and Dr. Morrow have given you an excellent overview of what happened at ASH in terms of lymphomas and leukemias, my focus is going to be essentially on myeloma and the advances which were presented at the recently concluded ASH meeting. And as always, ASH has been very exciting for myeloma, and this year was no different. But I'm going to kind of break it up because we learned a lot of things from some of the drugs, which I'm sure a lot of you are already on. And some of the data which was presented at ASH this year was certainly practice-changing. And the one which I think needs to be highlighted right up front is the data presented by the French. This was data presented by Dr. Thierry Facon of the IFM. This was presented at the plenary session, and as Dr. Morrow told you, the plenary session is the most highlighted scientific abstracts are the ones which are featured in this session. And this trial is called the FIRST trial, and it in fact is one of the largest trials which has ever happened in myeloma for the elderly patients. patients or patients who are not transplant eligible. Now, these were about 1,500 patients, and what Dr. Facon did in this trial was looked at the impact of lenalidomide or Revlimid in combination with dexamethasone, either given continuously or given for a stipulated 72-week time frame, or compared it with a third arm of drugs, which included melphalan, prednisone, and thalidomide. And what the overreaching conclusion of this study or the first trial was that in terms of overall survival as well as survival in terms of progression-free survival, the benefit was favored in terms of continuous use of lenalidomide and dexamethasone. Now, this is quite important because unlike in North America and United States, where we do tend to use lenalidomide and dexamethasone in the upfront setting, in Europe, melphalan prednisone still tends to be frequently used in combination with some of the other drugs. The other thing to note here is continued use of these drugs is what eventually gives people the benefit of both a survival advantage as well as remaining free of disease. So again, highlighting the fact that one needs to be on continued treatment with some of these agents. Again, Dr. Antonio Palumbo from the Italian group presented similar data in similar patient populations where he presented two separate trials, one trial comparing, again, the combination of lenalidomide and dexamethasone versus melphalan, prednisone, and thalidomide, very similar to Dr. Facone's data, and the second trial was comparing it to melphalan prednisone with another cytotoxic chemotherapy called Cytoxan. And the conclusion from all of these trials was the fact that lenalidomide dexamethasone tended to be the better combination, again suggesting that melphalan prednisone, in fact, should probably not be used, certainly in the upfront setting. Another very important feature, because this is something which people think about, the issue around second cancers in the setting of lenalidomide. Specifically, if you look at Dr. Fancorn's data, where he looked at lenalidomide dexamethasone in comparison to the melphalan prednisone-containing regimens, what Dr. Facon noted was a lower incidence of second cancers in people who were getting lenalidomide and dexamethasone. Another thing which we've learned about, and this is not new, but we've always known that lenalidomide maintenance in the transplant-eligible patients improves progression-free survival. In the study which was done in the United States, the CALGB study, in fact, showed a trend towards an overall survival benefit as well. But what was nicely presented at this year's ASH meeting was a meta-analysis of all lenalidomide maintenance studies. So they put all data of all existing lenalidomide maintenance studies together. And again, the conclusion from this study was the benefits of lenalidomide maintenance reflected on both improvements in control of the disease as well as people living longer. Now, you all are familiar with some of the other IMiDs, pomalidomide, which was approved earlier last year, and the other proteasome inhibitor, carfilzomib, again approved more than a year back now. What was presented at this year's ASH meeting was combinations of drugs with both the IMiD, both pomalidomide as well as carfilzomib. So data were presented on pomalidomide in combination with bortezomib and dexamethasone in a very relapsed refractory population, demonstrated response rates of greater than 70 to 80%, and these are patients where there's not a lot of options. So again, combining some of our newer IMiDs with some of our older proteasome inhibitors resulted in remarkable efficacy in this patient population. And if you think about carfilzomib, which is a newer proteasome inhibitor, we did see it being combined, in fact, with pomalidomide as well. This was data which was presented by the investigators at the MD Anderson Cancer Center, and what they were able to show, again, in patients who did not have a lot of options left, when you combined pomalidomide with carfilzomib, we ended up getting a response rate of about 70%, which is really quite remarkable. I think one other thing which was highlighted at this year's ASH was the fact that we have now the oral versions of some of these proteasome inhibitors, one of them being called ixazomib or MLN9708. This is probably further most in its development, and there was data which spoke to combining MLN9708 or ixazomib with lenalidomide in some of the relapsed refractory patient populations. Obviously, one of the key highlights for a meeting such as ASH is to look for new compounds and new drugs. And again, we did not we had a fair number of new drugs which were highlighted at this year's ASH meeting. I'm going to mention a few of them in the interest of time. One of them comes from, it's an array compound. This is specific. It's a kinesin spindle inhibitor. And again, in a very refractory patient population, response rate of about 25% was seen, and the future of this compound is to be combining it with drugs such as bortezomib. There are other classes of drugs which have been studied, and Dr. O'Connor mentioned some of these, the epigenetic drugs, or in this case, I'm focusing more on the HDAC inhibitors. We've had kind of a protracted course with HDAC inhibitors in myeloma, but at least at the beginning of this meeting, there was an announcement that the large randomized trial with panobinostat may have met its has met its progression-free endpoint. But what was presented at this ASH meeting, and largely from my group at MGH, was a more selective HDAC inhibitor belonging to the class 2B HDAC inhibitors, which targets mainly HDAC6. This is ACY-1215. It's an oral compound. We presented several different combination studies, one of them in combination with bortezomib, where we saw a 25% response rate and stability of disease in more than 60%. And when we combined this with lenalidomide, we saw the majority of patients, nearly 100% of our patients, responding to this combination. I think what was critically important here was the fact that this was extremely well tolerated. We did not have to dose adjust this medication. And again, as Dr. O'Connor and Dr. Morrow have pointed out earlier, these are more targeted, more specific drugs, and they're oral drugs, which are generally very, very well tolerated. Again, there's a lot of excitement. We've been a little bit behind in terms of antibody treatment compared to our lymphoma colleagues, but I do think we are making headways now, and there's been a lot of excitement around several different antibodies, some of them being tabalumab, we have elotuzumab, but what was highlighted at this ASH meeting was an antibody against CD38. CD38 is expressed on all myeloma cells, and we had an SAR antibody very similar to daratumumab, and as a single agent, for a monoclonal antibody, we've seen close to 25 to 30% response rate in patients with, again, relapsed refractory myeloma. There's a lot of focus on also trying to treat myeloma very early on, and part of this focus has been because of the fact that we have drugs which are fairly well tolerated. So Ola Langdon from the NIH actually presented very nice data on combining carfilzomib with lenalidomide and dexamethasone in smoldering multiple myeloma, to the extent in these patients he was able to actually see minimal residual disease status or complete absence of myeloma in these patients. But as Dr. Morrow pointed out in his talk, as with all of these clinical or scientific meetings, we also try and learn a lot about the biology of these diseases. And the one thing which is we learned about with myeloma was the fact that, you know, we've gotten to a point where we are able to look at the genes, we are able to look at the genetic fingerprint of the tumor itself. But what we have begun to understand is that there is a tremendous amount of genetic heterogeneity in myeloma, which is part of the reason why combining drugs will probably be the future of treatment with multiple myeloma. Now, again, as both my previous speakers have pointed out, there's a lot of excitement. There's a lot of new things coming down the pike. But with that excitement, you know, some of the field can get confusing. So what I would encourage most of you to do is reach out to centers where they have a lot of clinical trials, where they have information. And if you can get onto some of these clinical trials you have access to some of these new latest drugs, I think it's going to be of tremendous benefit to you as well as the disease also. And lastly, I'd just like to highlight the fact that, you know, quality of life is always an important issue. I think with myeloma, given that we've moved away from chemotherapy and gone on to some of these more biologic agents, we are really focusing on quality of life issues. And in fact, there were a lot of abstracts at this year's ASH where, depending on comorbidities, we actually learned to modify doses of all of these drugs, which we've begun to use as standard of care in the practice of myeloma. So not everybody needs to be on the highest dose of the drug, but talk to your clinician, talk to your team, and make sure that you're on a dose which you're able to tolerate without a lot of toxicities. And I think in the interest of time, Carolyn, I'm going to end here. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. O'Shea. Excellent presentation, as always. And just and now we have time for questions. Well, actually, we're not quite. We have one more speaker. We have Angelique Caba, actually. And Angelique is an oncology social worker. She's clinical coordinator of young adult services at Cancer Care. And she's going to present on the free psychosocial services that you can access from Cancer Care, as well as our support groups. Angelique?
Thank you, Carolyn. And so as an oncology social worker here at Cancer Care, I'd like to take just a few minutes to talk about the emotional and social impact of blood cancers and how Cancer Care can help. So when you're first diagnosed with a hematological cancer, it can be an overwhelming experience, you know, a time that's often filled with many questions, and it can even lead to like an underlined anxiety of the unknown. So talking to a Cancer Care social worker can really help you get the support you need. Cancer Care is a nonprofit organization that's staffed with licensed master's level oncology social workers, and all of our services are completely free of charge. So we're experienced in helping people manage the emotional, physical, as well as the financial challenges that, you know, come up with a cancer diagnosis, and we can continue to provide many of those services even after the treatment ends. And so one of the important things that I'd like to acknowledge about the emotional impact of a blood cancer diagnosis is that it can really feel like a loss, you know, a loss that manifests itself in many ways, both for the patients as well as the caregivers. And so that's why it's so important to have an outlet to be able to acknowledge how you're feeling and to have someone to talk to who can really be supportive and understanding. And this can mean talking to, you know, one-on-one with a Cancer Care social worker or even joining one of our support groups. And so speaking about support groups, Cancer Care offers face-to-face groups in our local offices in the New York area, as well as telephone and online groups. These groups are a real unique opportunity to talk to other people that are impacted by a blood cancer diagnosis, along with the help of a Cancer Care social worker to kind of facilitate that group. And so participating in a support group can really be, you know, a simple and helpful way to allow you to communicate and talk with others who are in a similar situation and who truly understand in a way that no one else can. So group members, it's a great way to get encouragement and a real sense of community that can provide you with additional support and guidance. And so lastly, as I had mentioned before, blood cancers can also have a significant impact on your finances. And for many of the people that I talk to on a day-to-day, this is an equally overwhelming aspect of the cancer. And so aside from the emotional support, Cancer Care also provides limited financial assistance to help with transportation to treatment, help with home care, or child care. And so as you've heard from today's discussion, there's quite a lot to think about. And so while we can't resolve all the problems that you're facing every day, a Cancer Care social worker can provide a listening ear and the ability to counsel you as you navigate the cancer experience. Many people living with cancer have really found this to be a reassuring and comforting service that can help you feel as though you're not alone. So please take this opportunity, and I encourage you to contact us at 1-800-813-4673, or you can log on to our website at www.cancercare.org for more information and to speak to one of our oncology social workers. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Ms. Cava. Wonderful presentation, and also to letting people know about all the services at Cancer Care. Well, now we do have time for questions. We have a lot of time for questions. I'm going to ask Stephanie to explain to everybody how to queue up for questions and to bring all of our speakers on board to address the questions. Stephanie?
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. If you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may click the green Q&A icon on the lower left-hand corner of your screen, type your question, and click send to submit. Our first question comes from Arlene L. Your line is open.
Yes, good afternoon. What is the newest mantle cell lymphoma drug?
Thank you for that question. And Dr. O'Connor, could you address that question?
Well, there are probably four. So the newest approved would be a drug called ibrutinib that was only approved a few months ago based on some very nice work conducted by Michael Wang and his colleagues down at the MD Anderson Cancer Center. And ibrutinib was that small molecule I mentioned earlier that targets this tyrosine kinase downstream of an important signaling pathway that drives the growth of these cells. So that's the newest drug approved. It's oral and pretty readily available, readily tolerated. About 6 months before that, lenalidomide was approved. Lenalidomide is one of those immunomodulatory drugs that you heard about in myeloma and some forms of lymphoma, and that drug works remarkably well with rituximab, and probably, in fact, all of these drugs will work better with rituximab, but that drug was FDA approved about 6 months ago, 6 months before ibrutinib. The two other drugs that are on the radar screen, one of which could be approved sometime in the next year or so, is called idelalisib, the PI3 kinase inhibitor that you heard Dr. Morrow speak about. That drug has pretty promising, and in fact, that class of drugs has very promising activity in mantle cell lymphoma. And the last drug is ABT-199, which you heard me talk about in CLL. In fact, the experience to date, where they treated about 8 patients with mantle cell lymphoma in a small study, all 8 of those patients happen to have responded, albeit they're all partial remissions, but that drug seems to have some pretty remarkable activity in mantle cell lymphoma. So the good news is there's not one new drug. There's actually those 4 that I mentioned and even a few more on the way, and a lot of promising therapies coming down the road in terms of giving us new insights into how to manage that disease.
Excellent. Thank you. And our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Barry S. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you. I have 2 questions that are, I think, related questions. One is, to what extent are the blood cancers, both in general and specifically, caused by genetic factors? We heard a lot about genetics today. And if it's not all genetic, what other factors do we know cause some of these blood cancers? And secondly, related to that, to what extent do the newer drugs cross the blood cancers? For example, ponatinib was mentioned for CML. Would that also work for CLL or for multiple myeloma? So those are the 2 questions. I'm thinking the genetic underpinning there might have something to do with drugs crossing over from one blood cancer to another in terms of effectiveness.
Well, thank you. That's an excellent question. And Dr. Morrow, could you address that question?
Sure. That's a great question. You know, I try to address that with folks right away because I talk, for example, when I see folks with CML, that the main underpinnings of the disease are a singular genetic abnormality that is really present in all the leukemia cells. But in general, blood cancers are uncommon to be heritable or essentially with us in our DNA or in our systems and waiting to manifest at some point in life. There are certainly some syndromes and predispositions that are known, but they're actually linked to what we know about the what we call sporadic or typical leukemias. So leukemias as a whole are thought to be due to some exposures certain chemicals and high doses of radiation can be leukemic triggers. A lot of the lymphoid or the non-myeloid cancers are really just a mistake during when the immune system is going through its normal course of arming us against the outside world. So in general, the genetics now help us understand what went wrong in a blood cell at any point, but not necessarily what was wrong with the blood cell at the beginning. It's true that we may have different categories of genetic abnormality, something that may be there for a long time, and when there isn't leukemia or yet, something called a founder or an additional primary clone or damaged cell, and then a secondary change happens. So there's a lot more to learn, but I try to reassure people to say that no, we don't have screening tools or knowledge of heritable cancers straight away, and there really aren't a lot of things that people can do to avoid risk of leukemia. We actually see a lot of folks who may be at risk for leukemia or even lymphoma based on secondary causes. They've had treatment for other cancers or chemotherapy for one disease, and they may be at risk for another. Second question, quickly, the drugs crossing over, that's probably easier to answer, and is that we're actually getting a little bit more specific with the drugs we develop. It's true that pathways clearly can overlap. There are multiple stories of a class of drug being developed and found to be useful in a very diverse group of cancers. Gleevec is a great example. It worked in a form of leukemia as well as a solid tumor, a sarcoma-like tumor of the gastrointestinal tract called a GIST. And those diseases are really clinically very diverse. The doctors that take care of those patients probably would never meet each other had it not been over the therapies like amantadine and the drugs that came afterwards. So while we drill down to specific targets, we're going to see drugs that are exclusively useful in one type of disease, but it always behooves us to look to see what other pathways may be active in other cancers. And we're coming across numerous cases where a drug used for skin cancer and thyroid cancer is now useful in a type of leukemia against a mutation called BRAF. So the pathways are very specific. There is some crossover, but not entirely, and it's a steep learning curve, as we say.
These are outstanding questions. And our last question, with early multiple myeloma, do studies favor early stem cell or Revlimid Decadron treatment? Dr. Rajay, would you address that question, please?
So again, Carolyn, I think that's a great question, and I think it stems from the fact that there was a paper which was published recently in the New England Journal of Medicine where the Spanish did a randomized trial treating patients with lenalidomide and dexamethasone if they had what we refer to as smoldering multiple myeloma. And in that study, patients who were treated with lenalidomide and dexamethasone did better in terms of clearly the disease control, but also lived a little bit longer. I'd be a little bit cautious about using drugs in the smoldering population just as yet, and I think we need to confirm this data in larger studies and studies done in different centers as well, because the way patients were selected in the Spanish study was based on a flow cytometric analysis, which is really not applicable all over the world. So I would hesitate to say that this, in fact, I would say that this should not be considered recommendation. If you do have smoldering or indolent myeloma, as we call it, I would certainly urge you to be in contact with a disease center which sees a lot of plasma cell dyscrasias. This is an area of intense research. There's a lot of different options out there and a lot of different clinical trials, and this is one area where actually immune therapies, the way Dr. Morrow had described in leukemias, also being tried in myeloma, where we're considering using a vaccination strategy in such situations. So again, I don't think everybody should be treated with lenalidomide dexamethasone, and I think you should be treated only in the context of a clinical trial in this situation.
Excellent. I want to thank you, and I want to thank all of our speakers. You've been outstanding, and I want to thank all of you who've been listening, those of you who've asked questions both on the phone and online. And we recognize that when you plan a program like this, that you have many issues and concerns that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour program. So I do want to remind you about all the services that Ms. Caba so eloquently described for you to access from Cancer Care. You know, we have about 35 oncology social workers here. We're here to provide a host of services, from practical and financial assistance to counseling services to educational programs like this one, as well as publications. And we have, of course, a website with lots of information. And, of course, our call center, our 1-800 813-HOPE line that you can call at any time. That's really, you know, we're here to help you. And so you can call us at any time for assistance and help. Most importantly, as we conclude the call today, I would not want anyone to feel you're alone in coping with cancer, with blood cancers. I want you to know that you're part of a community of support here and that we're here to help you. And we're simply a phone call away, and you can call us at 800-813-HOPE or 4673. So 1-800-813-4673. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect, and everyone have a great day.